the thing that interested me was this agitation and this feeling of precariousness and how it manifests itself.
So how do you react when you're not living a predictable life, and how do you deal with that?
Science Social, a podcast series about how science, history, and society connect with and add to the big questions that we all have today. This show is created by the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. My name's Stephanie Hood, and in each episode, I'm joined by a guest from our institute to talk about their research, their big questions, and some of the weird and wonderful experiences they've had along the way. Before the podcast starts, a note that we recorded this in summer 2023. The Earth, of course, has continued to turn, so whilst this episode makes connections to some contemporary issues, it doesn't necessarily reflect current world events. And now on with the show. And with this, welcome to another episode of the Science Social podcast, full of snapshots through history and fascinating research and researchers. Well, the past year, 2022 and 2023, could be described as having been somewhat precarious in one way or another. So today we're talking about how people have historically experienced and dealt with living in precarious times. And I have two guests with me, Noah Hegesh and Keith Knapp, who'll tell us a bit more about an era that researchers are just really starting to re-explore. We might compare this somewhat understudied time to what in Europe we would call the Renaissance. I'm talking about the period of division in China, which lasted from AD 220 to 589.
All right. This is a period of frustration, and since it's a period division, there's division between the North and South for much of the period.
This is Keith Knapp, one of the leading researchers of this period of division. He's an alumnus visiting scholar of the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science and is currently based at the Citadel Military College of South Carolina. Keith has published and co-edited several books on the topic and is also co-editor of the Cambridge History of China, Volume 2 on the Six Dynasties, 220 to 589. Okay, so to start off, what would you say life might have been like if you were a person living in the period of division?
In the South, you have Northerners who have been displaced by pastoral nomads who have moved into the North and have settled and set up states in the Yellow River Valley. And then you have many members of the elite and commoners who have fled to the Southeast along the Yangtze River Valley. And they're moving to a place that is just known as having all these aborigines and these languages that you can't understand. It's malarial, and it's just not home. And so they're not sure why they lost what they had, and they don't know if they can ever go back. If you were a Chinese who had already moved previously and sort of settled in the South, you're unhappy because you have all these Northerners coming down, taking your place, and they establish their own regime in Jingkang or modern-day Nanjing, and you used to be the big dog lording it all over those aboriginal people and other lower-class Han people that were already there, and now you're being lorded over by these emigres who have all sorts of strange habits and who sort of have this libertine sensibility to them. And you're really put out because you can't get promoted to high levels in government. At best, you could maybe get an honorary position, but you're sort of on the outs. So both sides are unhappy. So I think, you know, for so many people, it's a period of frustration. And of course, there's a fair amount of war as well. So this is a period, and Chinese don't usually like to talk about this period because they like to talk about the United Han or the United Sui Tang that came after this period, when China's civilization was great and the Chinese were in control. And yeah.
When we were thinking about the feature story, I was looking at Yan Zhetui and the instructions for the Yan family clan. And in one of the beautiful recent translations, there's this beautiful quote that starts with a sigh of, alas, you know, the world is such a big place. How come that it doesn't have a place for one body, for my own body?
Noah Hegesh is a historian of sound and a visiting postdoctoral fellow at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. She's interested in musical thought and sound as a technology in early and early medieval China. Her research focuses on the use of sound and tuning calculations during the period of division. This might affect areas such as astronomy, cosmology, metrology, through to politics, ritual, and divination. She's also brought together a working group looking specifically at transients in the period of division.
People are moving around. The reality around them is changing, and they have to adapt constantly. Yuanzhi Tui was constantly... He lived under four different rulers, and you have to survive each of them.
Some of my students know about this period because there's been a very famous video game based on it.
Oh, yeah. There are movies also, and there's, yeah.
Mulan is set in our period. So this happened in northern China, and it's not clear whether Mulan was Chinese or she was a pastoral nomadic person. And the poem, it's just a poem that this is based on. And actually, she addresses the emperor as Khan, which is a pastoral nomadic term for leader. And the live-action movie starts off in southeast China with this Hakka minority, circular buildings that were meant for defense, because the Hakka were guest people who locals oftentimes attacked. And of course, this had nothing to do with anything that connected with Mulan. But actually, the animated version of Mulan was actually much better done.
That's really evocative. You've actually partly led me to my next question. When was this period of division, and what would you say constitutes this period?
Well, you had already said it was 220 to 589, but it's got a couple of parts. There's a long period of warlords. And finally, by 220, one of the guys who has taken over most of the north, his son decides to, once his father dies, to actually stop being the strong man behind the throne and set up his own regime. And then two other local power holders, or strongmen, set up their own regime, one in the north, one in the southeast, and one in the west in Sichuan. And so that's called the Three Kingdoms. And then in 265, the prime minister of this biggest state, Wei, he overthrows his own ruler and then goes ahead and conquers. And so by 280, China is whole again. And this is under the Jin dynasty. And unfortunately, pretty soon all of the founder's sons are killing each other, trying to take over the throne. It's called the Chaos of the Eight Princes. And so once they sort themselves out, the Jin dynasty is completely weakened. And now pastoral nomads who have been used as auxiliaries decide, wow, this place is a mess. Why are we fighting for these guys when we can just take it over for themselves? And that's what they do. And so that's when these many Han elites and commoners make for the southeast. The north is completely a mess. There was something like 24 kingdoms. And then in the south, in Zhengkang, there's a total of five regimes. And so that becomes the southern dynasties. By 439, there's a group of pastoral nomads who finally unify the north. And that sets up the northern kingdoms, which last from 439 to 589. And eventually, it's one of the northern states that conquers all of it and reunites China.
Simple story.
I mean, it's a lot of years.
Yeah, but I mean, it's good to also put that against the backdrop of what it means to have the very long Han dynasty beforehand. So this very long period of unity is kind of always in the minds of the people that are experiencing this, you know, shift, even if a shift takes very long. I mean, this unification and then division, small unification, division, moving south, you know, people coming in from the north, 16 kingdoms, five, all of this is against the backdrop of what it means to have a kind of a, not utopia, but maybe idyllic past.
You know, one of the interesting things is that at the same time that people are feeling the effects of instability, of frustration, this is also a period of cultural flourishing.
You've explained already that this period of division is a time of significant social and cultural changes. So I thought we could look at a few concrete examples to see exactly what this means from your research field. So, Keith, your work focuses, among other things, on utopic and apocalyptic thinking. How would you say this changed, and how did it express itself, for example, in texts?
Early on in this period, there is Taoist thought about the apocalypse. The idea is that if you take all the writings that have ever been and put them all together, then you have all the knowledge and things are going to be A-okay. And so the person that I'm studying, Ge Hong, he believes that through his writing, you can learn how to become immortal and also how to solve social ills. And so he's giving you basically a do-it-yourself kit. And he has this faith that, yeah, as long as you are good to other people and you follow his directions, that, yeah, not only can you save the world, you can also become immortal and live forever. But this sort of optimism seems to die a death by the 5th century. And right at the same time, we also have in China, the birth of a Chinese Buddhism, which is called Pure Land Buddhism, where it's thought that, yeah, people are so corrupt, they can't be saved. And so now they have to put their faith in Buddhist spiritual beings who are going to save them. And so both from Taoism and Buddhism, people are just lost. They can't redeem themselves. They have to be redeemed by gods. And at the start of this period, we still see this faith that, no, humans can do it if they just have the right knowledge. And so we see this apocalyptic ideas take a stronger form. And also emperors who are smart start to say, oh, it just so happens that I am the savior and you've already been saved.
How lovely.
Yeah.
Then Noah, you work on sound and musical thought. Mm-hmm. How has sound, music, and their use reshaped and challenged during the period of division? How does this express itself in sound?
Ritual and music, these are the core of what it means to have rulership and to have what's called mandate of heaven. There's a well-known phrase in early China that is the sound of a dying state. And the sound of a dying state is a quote from the Lu Shi Chun Xiu, which is a text that was used a lot before the period of division. And it keeps coming up in period of division. Each dynasty that comes up or each ruler that comes up is thinking about what to do with the music. Should they go with new music? Should they adopt older, you know, schemes of music, ideas about music? And so sometimes they say, oh, that state's gone. This is history. I'm not going to use that. And this is the sound of a dying state. But every one of these dynasties, they're trying to create new ritual music that will signal stability. Because once you have that, you're establishing yourself as something that has continuity and it has the tradition. And so arguments begin about the system that should be adopted. And so the case that I'm studying kind of opposes the system that traditionally belongs to the Long Han period and the system that they think belonged to the even more distant in the past Zhou dynasty. And this becomes arguments that are acoustical in nature, that the ways that they are communicating about whether one system is better than another is not only by using moral ideas, but also by using acoustics, music theory, and saying, oh, you're wrong because the way that you are distributing sound across the year and the scale that you are using and the calculations that you're creating are wrong. And this is why.
Actually, a good subtitle for the period, it's the search for stability.
Yeah, yeah, the eternal search for stability.
So I wanted to talk about historiography. I mean, how has this period of division been treated so far in research?
For a long time, it wasn't. There's been a lot of research done in China and Japan. And then from Westerners too, and particularly at first German and French scholars led the way. And I think in the 20th century then, and post-war, then it became more American in that a lot of people were going to American institutions, no matter where they're from, to get trained in sinological research.
I can say from my end that when I was in my undergraduate studies, the period of division in the, you know, the big like tiny civilization entry course, it was like Han, and then they said something about there being a period of division, north, south, something about the seven sages, moving on to the Tang, because it was like a dark hole. It's too complex because there were so many different states, different changes and all of that, that they just didn't focus on it. Whereas now, in research and in general, I think it's written in several of the introductions that there used to be this thinking that Keith had mentioned, that the periods of unity are the ones that have all the wonderful cultural, you know, aspects that we should study, and unification. This is a period in between empires, right? This is a period between a unified Han, between a unified Tang dynasty. But actually now the cultural flourishing, the ideas, the art, the ways, different ways of thinking, and all these changes are much more the focus. And so this period is shining way more brightly than it did before. Yeah.
I mean, why do you think that this period of division is becoming more interesting, or people are engaging with it more, either students or within academia?
When I teach, I can see that there are certain things that are relevant to students that they enjoy more once I make the connection to today. So feelings of precariousness and change and stuff like that is a lot more appealing to them. And once you make that connection to concerns that they have today, then this is when I get engagement. And this time is a little bit precarious, right?
That brings me actually to my next point, because I wanted to talk more about transience. You are part of a working group, or there are several of you, researchers, historians, sinologists, forming an interdisciplinary working group on the topic of transience. Could you tell me if you just give me some direction about what kind of questions you're asking?
This idea of transience, the period of division is always described as tumultuous times of, you know, great uncertainty. And what I was thinking about, the thing that interested me, was this agitation and this feeling of precariousness and how it manifests itself. How does it influence what people are creating? How does it influence the creation of knowledge? How does it influence discovery? How does it influence the way people are thinking?
What does that mean for you individually and also as a working group?
When I get a chance to do a project, I always like to look at an entire fan of topics in order to create this sort of three-dimensional world, right? And so we have scholars that are studying astronomy, religion, archaeology, architecture, military, and all of these things are, they tie into each other and they give you a way of thinking about the place from which knowledge comes. You know, how are new ways of thinking created? How does this idea, you know, where is it coming from? Why are people even thinking in this way? What creates, what environmental, social history is creating the rise of these new ideas?
Well, first of all, I have to admit, I didn't even know what transience meant.
Some of the people in the group were like, trans-science? No, transience.
Having been immersed in this project, you know, for me, it's this dealing with rapid change and what do you make of it? What sort of reactions does it elicit? And how did people try to deal with it? So the figure that I'm looking at was a guy who was struggling with all the different demands and trying to come up with a solution. And he's forced to be a recluse, but at the same time, he's very committed to protecting society, and that actually social relationships are very important. And so he's just this amazing smorgasbord of contradictions, which makes it really interesting.
Somehow transient in his own being. Excellent segue to my next question, which was going to be, from this period of division, what kind of ideas and changes ultimately prevail coming out of it?
We see the North develop institutions that solidify the government. There's these the equal field system, where the government owns all the land and it distributes it to people based on their age, right? And so try to limit the number of large landowners. have the three elder system where you have respected local elders in charge of things. And so the Sui Tang period is well known for sort of the initial flourishment of the imperial civil service exams. All these ideas were kicked around and actually developed in the period of division. And what the Sui and its successor, the Tang, do is they take these institutions and they make them their own. And also they use Buddhism, right? And
I was going to say Buddhism, Taoism.
Yeah. Yeah, they use these as unifying ideologies and then have themselves identified as a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And so get buy-in from people who say, well, they're not only the emperor, they're a god.
I can say that for music, that it had become, throughout the period of division, a much richer cultural place with influences, instruments coming in, new instruments coming in from the Silk Road, new ideas about music coming in from the Silk Road, Buddhism and so on. And these things get carried on and used later in the Tang as well.
When you have Buddhism, there was already Buddhist foreign monks, but now it's being accepted and embraced by Chinese. And you have the growth of the second great religion of Taoism. And then you have fantastic scientific discoveries in astronomy and mathematics. You have calligraphy that's reaching new heights under Southern masters. You have beautiful paintings that are coming about. So oddly enough, even though politically the place is fragmented, divided, a mess, culturally, it's actually this mess helps nurture this cultural effervescence.
So moving from the past very much into the present, do you think we can make any parallels between all that this was happening in the period of division to the present day?
For me, what leaps immediately to my mind is Taiwan, because there in 49, you had the defeated nationalists come to the island, and they're just like the emigres coming from the north. They come into Taiwan, and they displace whatever leadership that the Japanese have. Actually, the Japanese have been controlling Taiwan until 1945. And then there's this friction between people who are called outside the province. That's not what they call themselves, but that's all the people coming from mainland China. And then there's all these original province people, Chinese who had been in Taiwan before 1949. And they have antagonistic relationships. They usually didn't marry each other. And it was the northerners or the people from the mainland who got all the jobs. This continued until Taiwan became a democracy. And then about that time, these families started to intermarry. And you always have this threat that the northerners, in this case, mainland China, is going to come over and take over. And that was true during our period, too, where, yeah, the Southerners had some military excursions up north, but it was never thought that, yeah, we're actually going to conquer this all. And instead, it was always the threat that the Northerners, who had a lot more military power, were going to come down and take everything. And so, you know, and in Taiwan, you know, people have a sense of precariousness, right?
I was thinking about Syria. I'm from Israel, and Syria is like my northern neighbor. And part of the huge destruction that was happening in that place displaced so many people who had to find a new place to build their lives and to settle, and at great costs, right? Emotional, financial, social, cultural, you know, and that is one thing that I was thinking. The other one is, of course, the current situation, the Ukraine. And the third was, of course, the pandemic, which was a very long period where people were trying to create new ways of living and new adjusting to new realities. You know, the reality of the past 3 years was accompanied by high amounts of stress, as well as new creative thinking about a lot of things. You know, I think institutions had to work differently, universities work differently, jobs work differently, reality changed and people had to adjust.
You've given some examples of transience around us right now, examples that can connect to today. How would you say these examples from the past maybe even let us see our present differently in some of these cases?
Especially coming from America, which is terribly divided, you have to muddle through. These people in the period of division, they muddled through. They tried to put their affairs in order as best they can. And they they had this search for stability where they looked for ways to make things better. Well, sometimes they hid. Sometimes they tried to build anew. Most didn't give in to despair. And that speaks to me in the present. I think you have to stick it out and work for the better. And that's how these folks inspire me.
How would you say that studying and understanding the period of division might help us understand human culture? What can it bring us today on a broader level?
I think Western scholars have always been attracted to, or in the last 30 years, to cultural history. And this is the meat of cultural history, right? That, how do people think and conceive of things? What sort of intellectual resources do they use to address it? And so I think now there's a lot more interest in how marginal groups were affected and how women lived their lives and dealt with these changes as well. And I think that's reflects the moment of time we're in, where we have questions about having a dominant class or group of people and what happens to everybody underneath and how do you get out of that position?
How would you say that dramatic transformations or transience, like in the period of division, might support and foster creation of new ideas or new cultural directions?
The thing is that the two most creative times in the Chinese past was the Warring States, when China was divided between seven huge kingdoms, often at war with each other, in the period of division. During the Warring States, it was called 100 schools of thought because there was this multiplicity of schools of thought that were all very different. And so it's precisely when you don't have stability, when there's no centralized government that can impose its way of viewing things, that you have all these different solutions. And during the Warring States and during the period of disunion, all these quick thinkers had to come up with ways of trying to improve things. And so I think, that makes them more open to different ideas. So in the period of disunion, or during the Han, there were already foreign Buddhist monks in China, but they were just foreigners and who cares? They have a few monasteries and, you know, it's not a big deal. In this period, it's like, oh, Buddhism, that's neat. What can we get from it? Oh, there's these Taoists who actually had sort of this rebellious start in 184 where they almost overturned the empire. Oh, yeah, what are the Taoists doing? Oh, immortality, alchemy, breathing exercise. Oh, this is good stuff. It sort of toned down Confucianism. It made intellectual room for people to look at different possibilities. And yeah, your life is a mess. Well, there's got to be different solutions out there. No, it's when everything is chaotic, there's really no central power that we can sort of welcome new possibilities.
I mean, I can take the opposite approach, but I don't believe in it necessarily. But I think you can find creativity in times of instability and you can find creativity in times of stability. But you have to look for it in times of stability, and it will be within the boundaries of what is given. So, for example, in a Han court, right, you would have the opportunity as an elite erudite person to provide your calendar, your new musical system, your arguments about it. And there will be a debate in court. There will be flourishing. Or if somebody like Liu An tries to bring subversive ideas and new ways of thinking, different ways of thinking against the current emperor, who is his relative, then you also get these tensions, you know. So they exist in times of stability and they exist in times of, but they are much more, I would say, colorful, identifiable, creative. And it's true also to say that, like, you know, the period of the Warring States is the bedding for the Han Dynasty, and the period of division is the bedding for, you know, what is known as the most cosmopolitan Long Tang Empire, which is considered, you know, one of the greatest empires in China. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. This is it for today. If you like what you just heard, we'd love your support. Click the subscribe button, recommend this to your friends and colleagues, or give us a thumbs up in your favorite podcast app. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere else you can listen to podcasts. Science Social is produced by the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. Music by Poddington Bear, and I'm the host, Stephanie Hood. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at MPIWG. And most of all, thanks for listening.